Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I want to talk a little bit about the first war on drugs that began in 1971 under Richard Nixon, the same year that another momentous decision by Nixon took place, the removal of America from the gold standard and the decision really to make the US dollar fiat money, which I'll come back to in a moment, because both the war on drugs and the removal of America from the gold standard have had massive implications, global implications, for the way the world is today. Now, those of you who are listening who remember the 1980s remember probably the second war on drugs, the war on drugs that was pursued by American President Ronald Reagan from the mid-1980s onwards. But it was a policy that had a serious pedigree. So let's go back to 1971 and see what it was that made Nixon begin this policy, which it's fair to say 4 decades later has been an unmitigated disaster in every conceivable manner. Nixon wins the presidential election in 1968 on the back of a rising sense that America has spiralled out of control. The lurid tales of sex and drugs, which really kind of concentrate to a tiny bohemian Hollywood elite, and the crisis in Vietnam, where what appeared to be a fairly small, localised war against a peasant nation had dragged 500,000 American troops into a never-ending quagmire by 1968, both gave Nixon an ideal platform to campaign from. Also, the fortunately for Nixon, less so for Bobby Kennedy, the assassination of Bobby, and the loss of the only main realistic Democratic challenger to Nixon meant that his path to the White House was a lot easier in 68. The presidential election at the end of that year, in that election, Nixon spoke to what he called the silent majority, the conservative with a small c, working class and middle class Americans who were appalled by the disorder within the country that they were seeing, the rioting at the Democratic National Convention, the growth in crime in inner cities, and drugs and drug use was attributed to this. Obviously, you have a developing counterculture, which LSD is an important part, and a drug culture that had been growing since the 1950s. but sort of dramatically increases, largely probably for demographic reasons, in the mid-1960s. You have a large young population with more spare income than it's ever had before. That's not to suggest that everybody who was under 18 and had some money in their pocket was out buying drugs. Far from it. The supply of narcotics in America in the 1960s is relatively conservative. Most people in the 1960s don't smoke any marijuana. They don't take LSD. As with all these things, the people who inhabit a counterculture are normally a very small minority. The same can be said of Britain in the 1960s. Most people's experience of both Britain and America in the 1960s, you'll probably find, is extremely boring. But it's the perception that matters. The perception that America was becoming more lawless, that drugs were part of the problem. And drugs often, moral panics like drugs, are often kind of code for something else. They're often code for social change. As black Americans became more empowered throughout the 1960s due to civil rights legislation, and as a younger generation began to take the place of the older one that had replaced it, the natural sense of conservatism, again with a small c, that exists within probably most people, saw this as a frightening, threatening, and unprecedented change. And the issue of drugs, which starts to be spoken about more and more in the press throughout the 1960s, becomes a focal point for this moral panic and anxiety. Is it LSD that is changing the youth of America, making them think these largely un-American things? At the time of the Second World War, many people in their 40s and 50s who perhaps served in the Second World War would have found it abhorrent, the idea that large numbers of their countrymen were protesting against the war while they were off serving it. The generation who had returned from the war, who had been the beneficiaries of the GI Bill, who had set up homes after 1945, or small businesses, or become educated, and had seen the war as the good war, now, 25 years later, are indignant and outraged that there are what is seen as being privileged and spoiled middle-class brats campaigning to undermine the efforts of GIs fighting in Vietnam. And so there's definitely a kind of a class element to all of this, something that Nixon happily fostered. Nixon himself, who presented himself as this hard-done-by blue-collar Joe who had risen through his own talents and successes, which is, largely the case, and had to put up with the supercilious and arrogant Kennedy brothers who had every privilege handed to them, he was happy to kind of project this onto a national stage and present the college graduates who had protested against the Vietnam War and the students as layabouts and bums. I think it is the term he uses after the Kent State shooting in 1970. These layabouts and bums, who do they think they are? And this chimed with blue-collar America, who did these entitled children think they were. And again, there is the suspicion across blue-collar America that it was the children of the wealthy, the overeducated middle classes who were taking LSD and smoking marijuana and experimenting with all sorts of new and un-American ideas. And so you get this fusion of politics and the idea of the drug together as a kind of a sort of like an emblem for that which is un-American. And certainly to an older, more conservative generation, taking LSD is seen as distinctly un-American or alien. And this is where you get a kind of ripe territory for anti-drugs legislation. Now, it's often been said that anti-drugs legislation that had been introduced in piecemeal fashion since the 19th century had its own racial biases, and there's probably an awful lot to this, that opium, the drug of Chinese labourers working on the transcontinental railroads, this was banned when there were moral panics about the Chinese, which were basically motivated by fears that cheaper Chinese labour would take white American jobs. The Jim Crow laws contained laws against the use of cocaine, partly because cocaine in the 1900s was synonymous with black Americans in the South, though it seems highly unlikely that it was contained and limited to them. Marijuana and cannabis use was criminalised because of xenophobic attitudes towards Mexican and Hispanic Americans. But up to the 1960s, these are drugs that are not policed with the kind of the fervour that they are in the 70s and 80s. There are people who are a small, tiny minority of people who are known to have addiction to things like cocaine or morphine. There is little understanding of how to treat these addictions. For those that have lots of money, often psychoanalysis was used, but then again, psychoanalysis was the seen as the kind of the received wisdom of the day. It probably had very little value in terms of actually treating addiction, and there's a good reason why psychoanalysis isn't used as the kind of the dominant tool for addiction treatment today. Now, the issue of the war on drugs kind of revived itself this year in March, that's 2016, when a journalist, Dan Baum for Harper's, interviewed John Ehrlichman from Nixon's staff at the time, and Ehrlichman had some revealing stuff to say. He said, "The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people." This was John Ehrlichman, who's the domestic policy chief for Nixon. He goes on to add in the article, "You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, and then criminalising both heavily, we could disrupt those communities." Ehrlichman added, "We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." And this is consistent with much of Nixon's thinking, this highly paranoid individual who took things incredibly personally. I know it sounds awfully familiar, doesn't it? Who saw criticism of the Vietnam War as personal criticism of his policy, which, you know, much of it was, the secret bombing of Cambodia and that kind of thing, and saw particularly in the Black Power movement, not necessarily the Civil Rights movement, because that was quite easy to contain, but the Black Power movement, a deadly existential threat to him and his presidency. So he had his enemies lists drawn up where, you know, the likes of Noam Chomsky, for example, was there. He had this kind of hatred of the what he viewed as the liberal media. Again, seeing himself as this kind of persecuted blue-collar guy done good, sneered at by liberal elitists everywhere. And he was happy to find ways to undermine his enemies. Obviously, one clearly being, you know, against the Democratic Party, booking of the Watergate Hotel.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But the war on drugs is another part of this kind of Nixon worldview. And the consequences of his decisions in 1971 have been quite literally world-altering. The war on drugs that was fought throughout the 1970s, 80s and 90s, and is still being fought, has cut a bloody swathe of countless lives in South America. I'm not sure a full study of the death toll of the war on drugs has been concluded, but if you even look at American intervention in Colombia, for example, you're looking in the tens of thousands of dead in the wars in the 1980s between the American government, the Colombian government on one hand, and the Medellin cartel on the other. Now, here is a revealing statement from Nixon in 1969. He said, "Within the last decade, the abuse of drugs has grown from essentially a local police problem into a serious national threat to the personal health and safety of millions of Americans. A national awareness of the gravity of the situation is needed. A new urgency and concerted national policy are needed at the federal level to begin to cope with this growing menace to the general welfare of the United States. Between the years 1960 and 1967, juvenile arrests involving the use of drugs rose by almost 800%, half of those now being arrested for the illicit use of narcotics are under 21 years of age. New York alone has records of some 40,000 heroin addicts, and the number rises between 7,000 and 9,000 a year. These official statistics are only the tip of the iceberg, whose dimensions we can only surmise." Now, bear in mind what Ehrlichman had to say, that Nixon knew full well that many of the things he was saying about drugs were not true. The reliability of this data, well, it will take a researcher with more time than me to figure that one out. But it's entirely possible that these are not valid statistics. But we won't go there. So he then goes on to speak at length about, in quite an ill-informed manner, about the impact of drug addiction. He says, it has been a common oversimplification to consider narcotics addiction or drug abuse to be a law enforcement problem alone. Effective control of illicit drugs requires the cooperation of many agencies of the federal and local state governments. It's beyond the province of any one of them. At federal level, the burden of the national effort must be carried out by the Departments of Justice, Health, Education, Welfare and the Treasury. In 1972, it was recommended by the Congressional Commission on Drugs that marijuana be decriminalised, or at least personal possession, personal use of marijuana be decriminalised because of the really kind of trivial harm that's associated with it, almost none whatsoever, really. And 11 states between 73 and 77 decriminalised marijuana. And in 1977, Jimmy Carter ran on a platform which partly involved the decriminalisation of marijuana as well. But something curious happens during the 1980s, really. The culture war in America that the 60s seems to have given birth to enters a new phase. The 1970s are seen generally as a particularly bad time in America, a time of economic and social crisis, a time of foreign policy defeat and failure, and the decade beforehand, the 1960s, are by the conservative right blamed for this. And so in 1980, when Ronald Reagan is elected, taking office in 1981, promising morning in America, you know, a new dawn, a new start for America. The figure who embodies the kind of the anti-60s backlash steps into power, and with him is, you know, you can't just simply say it was all Ronald Reagan. I mean, that doesn't make sense. An entire generation of people who have turned their backs on what they perceived to be the 1960s. So the 1960s are, as a decade, it can be many things, but they perceive it to have been the kind of the chaos and disorder of the Woodstock generation. Are perfectly happy when Reagan launches his own war on drugs. So the 1980s and 1990s see a huge increase in incarceration. Because of dramatic new fronts opening up in the war on drugs. For non-violent drug offenders, there were 50,000 in jail in 1980 and 400,000 in 1997. There are kind of all sorts of alarmist media visions of drug users. The president's wife, Nancy Reagan, as all first ladies do, had her own cause. It was the anti-drugs movement. It chimed very nicely with the Christian conservative right, who supported Reagan and who voted for him in large numbers. And it could be incorporated into a wider conversation on public morality. She has her Just Say No campaign, and there is a zero tolerance policy adopted in many American cities for drug use, drug dealing, and drug possession. In LA, the police chief there, Darrell Gates, said that casual drug users should be taken out and shot. And there is a typical example of the thinking of the time. Launched a project called DARE, which was taken on nationwide, which was based around zero tolerance of drug use. There was no evidence as to its efficacy, as there often one with these kind of pilot initiatives, but it was rolled out nationwide probably because it sounded good. And drug policies throughout the 1980s also have a knock-on effect on the development or on the contagion of HIV and AIDS, which becomes, in the second half of the 1980s, the other great moral panic of the decade. The US government and its helpers in the media had, by the end of the 1980s, brought about an astonishing change in public ideas. In 1985, 2% of the population saw drugs as being the biggest problem in the States, but by 1989 it was over two-thirds. It was coming up to 66% of the population, and who see drugs as this kind of monolithic crisis for America. But that was, of course, in an election year. And interestingly, the figures of Americans polled who thought it was the worst problem in the States falls to 10% the year after. So that gives you a clue, really, doesn't it? I think the final point to make about the Reagan years, without going into studying Noriega, the CIA, shipments of drugs from South America to fund all sorts of wacky initiatives like equipping, the Taliban with Stinger missiles, or trading missiles to Iran for the release of hostages, or any of this kind of stuff, is the issue of the reason for America's involvement in Colombia. And again, this is the subject of another podcast, really. But it has a similarity with Britain's opium wars in China. In slightly a reversed way, the British wished to sell opium to China to address a balance of trade problem. The British in the 1840s, 1830s, had been buying lots of silk and tea and other nice things from China, and the Qing emperors had said to the British, well, we don't want any of your manufactured goods, which is, Britain's comparative advantage and the thing it sells around the world in order to afford all sorts of nice luxuries. This left the British with a big problem. There was a huge outflow of wealth from Britain to China to pay for, tea and silk and other things. And so in order to get money flowing the other way again, opium was the trick. Now, in the 1980s, in about 1983, when the Reagan government realised how much money was leaving Miami and other American cities for Colombia, they realised that it was well worth their efforts becoming involved in the destruction of the Medellin cartel, which eventually happens by the early 1990s. By this point, by the time the Americans decided to get involved, many of the cartels' own sicarios and killers had decamped to Miami and were shooting it out in the streets. It wasn't the gun battles in the streets of Miami that really affected American policy. It was the balance sheets when observed in Washington. But it was the intervention of America in Colombia and the demand by the American government for extradition that sparks a civil war in Colombia that is interestingly fought for the first time between a government and a private individual, that being obviously Pablo Escobar. There's a really interesting bit in The Age of Extremes by Eric Hobsbawm when he points out that one of the more curious features of the 20th century is, for the first time, you have criminality becoming a global phenomena, and largely due to the war on drugs. And you have criminal networks being able to challenge states, perhaps slightly weaker states like Colombia, for the first time. So the war on drugs itself and the development of the global narcotics business is a massive structural part of the 20th and the 21st centuries, something that requires an immense amount of exploration and can easily be accidentally dismissed as just one of these trivial side features of our time. But it's definitely not. The use of drugs on a mass scale, the mass intoxication of entire populations, I mean, obviously, alcohol is the main one, but mass intoxication now of large percentages of the population, shall we say, through narcotics, various, has all sorts of profound social, economic, cultural, and political questions attached to it, in the way that we see not just the 21st century is unfolding in front of us, but the decades from the 60s onwards. Anyway, this has gone on far too long, so I'm going to finish there, and I'm going to put some related video stuff to the war on drugs onto the YouTube channel later on this week, and also some stuff about the gold standard. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.